Good evening. My name is Sharon Tremaine, and I'm an alcoholic. It's my pleasure and honor to be asked to share with you tonight. My sponsor always told me when I first got here, don't make any notes, don't make any plans. You never know if you're really going to make it or not. Just get up there and ask God to speak through you. Tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now to your individual life. And that's what I'll try to do for you tonight. Fortunately, when I got here in November of 1979, I'd had it. I was introduced to AA in 1977, and for 2 years, I jerked around with the program every way possible. I twisted and turned. I conned and connived. I went to a meeting here and there. I left again. I didn't want to be one of those people. I thought that the worst thing that could ever happen to me in the world was to become an alcoholic. My dad was an alcoholic. He just passed away this past November at 86 years old. He drank for 70 years. I spent a lot of my youth trying to figure out what was wrong with me and why my dad didn't love me and why he didn't want me and why he'd push me away and why the only time he ever noticed me was when I was doing something wrong or something that annoyed him. I got his attention. And even a shove or a rejective word or a push meant a lot to me because that's the attention I got from him. The first time I can remember having an anxiety attack, I was 5 years old. And I started school many years ago. My daughter asked me if they had stage coaches when I started school. And I said, gee, they probably did. I have a 30-year-old and I also have an 11-year-old. And that little 11-year-old and I are going through some wonderful experiences because I'm old enough to be her grandmother, but I'm her mom. And, you know, she figures, well, back then, Mommy, you know, were there Indians in New York when you went to school? So, at five, when I started school, they had this system in New York where they could test the little children, and if you passed certain tests and you were able to, I don't know, jump through hoops or whatever, they decided you were ready for school. And in those days, very little was paid attention to the feelings of the child or what the child wanted. And all I remember was that first day of school and that big yellow bus was coming down the road, and it was coming for me. And the steps, I don't know if any of you, we're all pretty big now, but if you remember when you were little and your legs were this long and the bus steps were this high, and I saw this thing and I started to just freak out, how am I going to get in the bus? And strangely enough, the bus stopped and the doors opened and arms picked me up and sent me in the bus. And it was my neighbor, it was a young man that was in high school because we all took the same bus, and he put me in the bus. And today I know that those kind of miracles happen every day. But my terror didn't even let me realize that this young man was behind me. I think that was my first experience with a higher power, was being lifted into that bus, because I spent my whole life wondering, how am I going to get on that bus? How am I going to do it? How in God's name am I going to get on that bus? And the bus I was looking for was the bus of life. It seemed the more I got and the more I did and the more things that worked out for me, the emptier I felt, the less I felt I belonged, the less I felt that I wanted to be where I was. And yet I always denied those feelings. I never admitted them to myself or anybody else. I just kept on going and going and going. I know today that a lot of the experiences I had as a young teenager were toward my dad. I did anything and everything to get his attention. And as I mentioned earlier, I got attention from him when I wasn't following along with the ducks in the row. I was wild. I ran around. I discovered boys when I was 14. I went through a stage between 10 and 12 where I was real fat. And I think that was my first addiction. But anyway, there was a boy that I had loved since third grade. And when I was 13, he said to me, you know, Sharon, I really like you and I really think you're pretty, but you're too fat for me. That was the end of that addiction. I got new ones. I went from food to boys. And I spent a few years doing that. And I had one boyfriend after another, and this one boy was always in the background. And I finally became his girlfriend, and we were friends for 2 years. And that was the first experience I ever had with somebody loving me, of actually loving me and caring about me. And I think, thinking back, I was very, very blessed because that young man truly loved me. It was a puppy love thing. but I felt that feeling of somebody caring about me, saying, what do you think? You know, or what do you feel? I never knew what that was like. We were the typical alcoholic family. The outside of our house was beautiful. We had a nice porch. Everything was immaculate. If you went by our house, you would say, oh, look at that nice home, and look at that nice family, and look at those kids. They wear patent leather shoes, and they go to Sunday school. And inside, it was so cold. And it was so scary. And you never knew what was going to happen next. The raging, and the crying, and the fighting, and the screaming, and then the total stone-dead silence, which was, in fact, a blessing. Total silence was a blessing. I can remember being a little kid, and at night, hearing my parents rage and scream, and getting in my bed and put all the covers over and then stick my fingers in my ears, and I fell asleep that way. Because that was the time that all the fighting went on. I didn't realize that that was what I was learning. I was learning how to live that way. And that's what I was picking up on. I got married the first time when I was 17 years old. I ran away to get away from home. My father and I had a duke it out fight, and he wound up chasing me around the house with a butcher knife. And the man I was dating at that time took me away. We had run away previously and gotten married, and I was going to stay home and go to school, and we weren't going to tell anybody. But I wound up leaving with him, and shortly thereafter I became pregnant. Had my first child when I was 18 years old, a daughter. That's my daughter, who today, Lisa, is 30. I didn't want to be with that guy. I had no idea what being married or being a wife or being a mother was about. Didn't have a clue. All I know was that he took me away from what I was in, and I hoped that it would be better. It didn't take long for me to realize that it was worse. My husband was a drinker, very, very heavy drinker. In those days, I still didn't drink. I still had no compulsion for alcohol, none whatsoever. I still lived in the fear of, I don't want to be like my dad. But my husband drank heavily. We had my daughter Lisa when I was 18. And I remember going home after having that baby. I had no idea how to take care of a baby, but here I went home with this little 6.5-pound scrap of life. And the nurses, when I went out the door, said, see you next year. And I said, oh, they'll never get me back here again. Oh, yeah, I'm never coming back here. Sure enough, 12 months later, back I went. And so by the time I was 19, I had two children. I had Lisa, and I had a son by then by the name of Todd. So now I was 19 years old with two babies and a husband that drank more. And my husband was an Italian man from New York, and he, to this day, we're not sure what he does for a living. But he always made a lot of money, and I always had a lot of stuff, you know. I really had it good till he used to go to jail, you know. And he never let me know when he was going to jail. He'd say, I'll see you later, and 90 days later, he'd come out of Rikers Island or somewhere, you know. And here I was with these two babies and no income. In those days, you didn't work, you know. You stayed home barefoot and pregnant. And no allowances were made for the times. You know, all the money was buried down the backyard in a can, you know. So, and I didn't know where those cans were. So it got pretty rough, you know, when I was by myself with the kids. And I got a lot of resentments, and I got real fearful. But fortunately, there was always a way. There was always a way to get by. You know, I tell my landlord, look, you know, Joe's in the hospital. I think he had four appendix removed while I was with him, because it's like, you know, geez, my husband's in the hospital, and you know, and as soon as he comes out, I'll pay the rent. And sure enough, as soon as he got out, boom, 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 you know, there were the bucks, so they finally let us slide, you know, and that's how we lived. I was 20 years old and decided I don't want to live like this anymore. And I was sick of him anyway. So I packed up at 20 with two babies and set out to seek my fortune in the world. Said, later, I'm out of here. And took off, went to upstate New York, lived there. I was working in a supermarket. I had no trade because right out of high school I got married. I was supposed to go to nursing school and I didn't go. So I was working in the supermarket and a man came along one night and he was buying fruit for his nightclub. And he came over to me and he said, why are you working here? And I said, oh, I have two babies to support. And I'm making some money here and I have to make ends meet. And he said, you know something? He said, if you will come to... He said, how would you like to work in a nightclub? And I said, well, I've never done that before. He said, well, if you'll come to work for me, I'll train you to be a bartender and to work in a nightclub. You'd be wonderful at it. And I said, well, I don't have a car and I don't know how to drive. He said, that's all right. I'll pick you up and I'll take you home. And sure enough, I was 21 by then. This man and his partner trained me to work in their nightclub. It was in upstate New York, if any of you know New York, Newburgh, outside of Newburgh. It was a cranking area at the time. Boy, rocking and rolling, the Air Force Base, everything was happening. It was a beautiful nightclub. They had a lot of name bands and things like that, and they trained me to be the bartender. And for some reason, it came real quick to me. And I was desperate. I had to support these kids, you know? I loved those little babies. I loved those children. I was such a scatterbrained nitwit, but I loved those kids. We played like little kids. You know, I used to sit on the floor with them. I had as much fun with their toys as they did. I never had a chance, really, to be a child. And so I went to work in this nightclub, and I started making some bucks. And these people were very, very good to me. And they took me to work, and they brought me home. And I worked there the better part of a year. And then I got another job. A man came in there one night, and he said to my bosses, I want her. And this man was another person from New York who had a club, very private club. And I went to work for him, and I made a lot of money. And I ran that club, and I managed that club for that man. And I learned the business inside and out. He trained me for everything. He's a very old man. And he told me that he had known Jean Harlow years ago. He ran with Jean Harlow, and he said, you remind me of Jeannie. And strangely enough, Jean Harlow died at 36 from the effects of alcoholism. Her kidneys shut down, and she died. He told me her whole story, and I got sober at 36. And I don't know if that was an omen then or what. But he used to say to me, kid, you got larceny in your heart. You got larceny in your heart. He said, if you don't do something with that larceny, he said, I don't know what's going to become of you. And I said, well, if you had to deal with the stuff I have to deal with, you'd need some larceny too. So I went on and I did pretty good then. I drank once when I was 21 years old on my birthday. I drank Brandy Stingers and I had about three of them passed out. And I got so sick, I said, oh God, I can't believe this. Why do these people do this? I never had another drink. For years, I didn't drink. Once in a blue moon, I'd have one of those little things with the umbrella hanging out, you know, on a birthday or something like that. But I never even finished the drink. I was not a drinker. A couple of years down the road, I was making real good money. I had a little house for the kids and I. My family always used to say to me, you're going to wind up a prostitute, and those kids are going to wind up in foster homes. That's what's going to happen to you when you're working in a bar, you know. And here they were drinking away, you know. I thought, oh, my God, oh, my God. Well, another person came along in my life, a young man who was up and coming in show business, and we met, and he told my boss the first night that he ever met me, I'm going to marry her. And I said, oh, really? Well, wound up, it was the easier, softer way. Hey, he had it all, and I wanted it, you know. So off I went. There I was. I was 23 years old. I was married for the second time, and I had three children. Had another daughter, Tammy, my second husband. Beautiful little baby. And I lived a very, very good life, materially and socially and things like that, for almost 10 years. My husband was a conductor and a writer and a pianist, and he had a show band in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains. He did real well. We had a big house with a lake and all this other stuff. I never knew why. I always had that kind of icky feeling inside, like, what is wrong with me? What is wrong with me? I don't want to be here. I don't want to be with him. I don't want to be here. And then the guilt set in. And then I would try once in a while to talk to somebody and say, God, I've got it. And people would say, Sharon, you've got it all. You've got it all. Look at your life. You've got it all. And I thought, I do? And I didn't feel like I did at all. I was so lonely inside, and there was just something in there that was telling me, this isn't all it is, but I don't know what it is. When I was 30 years old, had the three children, had the beautiful home, had a perfect life, had everything. I was so lonely and so empty. I went away for a weekend with my cousin. And I'm Swedish. Swedish and Norwegian, and I don't know if you heard about the Scandinavian drinkers, but it's all true. And my cousin and I, girl cousin and I, we each had three kids. We took our kids and we were up at my aunt's lake house, way, way up in the mountains. And she brought in booze and wine and all this kind of stuff, and she said to me, we are going to have the best weekend of our life. We got six little life jackets, tied the kids up, went out on the dock with a gallon of wine, and got blitzed. absolutely blitzed. And we had the life jackets on the kids if they fell off the dock. You know, we could just fish them out. And there we were. We had these little kids bobbing around the life jackets, you know, and we were snockered on the dock. It was, in fact, the best weekend of my life. I loved it. It finally dawned on me what was missing. I said, I can stay smashed the rest of my life. I don't even have to feel like this. I felt great. It was wonderful. I felt connected. My cousin and I talked about all sorts of things. Nobody ever talked in those days. People just said, I don't talk about these things, you know. Well, we talked about all those things. And we both decided our husbands were jerks, we weren't happy, but we had good lives, we had a lot of money, and who cares? We'll just drink. And so, it was good, you know? We just kept fishing those kids out of the water and having another drink. Well, that started something for me because whenever things started to get to me a little bit, I knew that I could go have a few drinks. Eventually, I could go have a few drinks, and I did something I thought I would never do. I took a lover. Young man, 8 years younger than myself. I became friends with him, and we ran around together for about a year. And here I was, married woman, known in the town, the community, the whole nine yards, and I'm running around with this cute young thing, guilt-tripping myself to death because truly and honestly in my bones I didn't think it was right, but who cares? Who cares? I didn't care. I got to a place, the more I drank, the less I cared, and the better it felt not to care. So the more I drank. My marriage ended after 10 years. I packed my bags and I left. I just walked out. In fact, I left one night. I decided, and I got some people together, and that's just how I did things in those days. I said, I'm leaving my husband, and that's it. I don't want to live like this anymore. So he went to work, and he had a big show to do and a lot of people to meet, and he had a rehearsal, and he had all kinds of stuff. I got these people together, and they came with trucks, and I cleaned out my house, and I left him a bed and a table and a jar of capers in the refrigerator. Why I left those capers, I'll never know. I could have used them. And that's how I was gone. Within 2 years, that man had two major heart attacks, and his career was practically ended. He became an invalid. He also had open kidney surgery from the drinking and the grief and the shame and the pain that was caused by such an unruly wife. And this young man was Jewish, and his mother never finished telling me. If she's up there now, she's probably still telling me, you ruined my Donnie's life. You ruined his life? You ruined his life. And you know I probably did. Thing was, though, that today I know that I didn't know. One of the things that this program has given me is the ability to know that I didn't know, and that's been one of my greatest blessings, was to find that out. I left that husband. I immediately hooked up with another man. Had 4 years of the type of stuff, you know, wild drinking, chasing each other around town, running each other over with cars and, you know, duking it out and chasing each other around and getting drunk. Oh, my God, four years of the wildest life in the world. Took those three kids and put them into that life. And he had four, and we put his four into it. So now we were the Brady Bunch. The only thing we left out was we were the drunken Brady Bunch. You know, we weren't like that TV bunch, let me tell you. But we did have a lot of fun, and strangely enough, the kids had a good time, too, because there were no rules, there were no regs, there was no anything. They just kind of did their own thing, you know, and the bigger ones helped the little ones. And we used to just go to wild places and take the kids and travel and do crazy things. That ended. All of a sudden, one day I got up and said, I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to be here, and I don't want to be with you, and I'm out of here, and I'm moving to Florida. My two children, the two oldest, Lisa and Todd, were starting to give me some problems. I can't understand why. I mean, they had the perfect home. What the heck were they starting? My son was smoking weed instead of delivering his paper route and drinking Heinekens here and there. He was 13. My daughter was hanging around with an unruly crowd, you know, some kind of wild kids and stuff. And I thought, oh, how dare they? Look what they have. How did they start like this? And here I am with the drink in my hand saying to my son, you little druggie. You know, I finally decided to connect with my first husband. I hadn't seen him. He disappeared. I didn't hear from him for about 12 years. And I thought, that's it. It's time they met their father. They had no idea who he was. Never saw the guy. Through his parents and whatever, I found out that he was hiding in Oklahoma. In some town with about four people in it, and I left a message, and he called me back, and I said, it's time you met your children, you know, this is time, And he said, well, Sharon, you know, I've wondered for many years, but I figured I'd leave you alone, and I'd like to see who my children... I'd like to know these kids. I said, good, because they'll be on a bus tonight. And I took those two kids, the two big ones, and I said, pack your bags. You're going on a little trip. Where are we going? I said, you're going to Oklahoma to meet your dad. Packed their bags, and off they went. Put them on a bus for Oklahoma. And said, I love you. Have a good time. And I truly did love them, but that's all I knew to do. It was like, they need their father. Look how weird they are. You know, I've done all I can here, and they're getting weird. It's all his fault, they're his, and he might as well deal with it. So off they went, and after the kids were gone, I grieved so bad that I put the kids on a bus couldn't stand myself. So I decided it was that man I was with. It was really his fault that I put those kids on the bus, because he drove me crazy. So I left him, took my daughter Tammy, and moved to Florida. Same type of leaving. Like, later, I held an auction off in my condo, and I was on the second floor. And I was letting the stuff down for sale by ropes. Bombed out of my mind. Oh, you want this table here? People are down there. I'll give you $2. It was great. So we moved to, my little daughter and I moved to Florida, and I had some really neat friends in Miami. Same type of people I was used to in New York. You know, we never knew what they did for a living, but they had plenty of money, and we didn't care. And I started running with this crowd, and now I knew a lot of show business people, too, from my second marriage, so I hooked up with a lot of them, and we ran around Miami, and we had a good time, and I got real, real good jobs. I was real experienced in the food and beverage business, and I always got jobs. I was working for Americana. I was the first woman bartender for Americana Hotel over in Bell Harbor, and it all went well until the union men, they didn't want women in the union, and they were trying to get me in union, so they decided that these men were plotting to kill me. And the word got out, and the head food and beverage guy came and said, look, we got you a job with Holiday Inn because your life isn't worth much here. You're out of here. And they did. They actually got me a job with another firm because they were afraid of my life. They thought they were going to kill me. I didn't care. You know, have another drink. So don't kill me. I always loved that old Peggy Lee song, and I used to sit and get bombed by myself. I was very, very careful about my drinking. I rarely went out in public and had any more than a few and partied and danced and had a good time. When I did my serious drinking, I did it when I came home. I played music, and I'd get into myself, and I'd wonder what it was all about, and I would drink. And I would just keep drinking till I passed out. And I didn't think there was anything wrong with me, though, because most of the time I was still functioning. I could hold a job. I could take care of a home. I knew what was going on most of the time. And I didn't know that I didn't know at all what was going on. That was a pretty exciting time, though. You know, I was running with some real wild people, and my little daughter, Tammy, was 9 years old. Lots of times, Mom wasn't home. You know, I'd say, well, I'll be home at 5, and I'd make it home at 8. I'd come home, and she'd be, Mommy, where were you? And I had to meet some people, you know. I really missed you. I wanted you to help me with my homework. Well, Tammy, you know how it is, you know. Don't you see you have everything? Don't you have a pony? How many kids have a pony? You've got a pony. You have a wonderful life. Don't bother me. I didn't know. I stayed in Florida for a few months that year, and that was in 1977. I remember driving to Florida, and that was when Elvis died. And God, I drank at Elvis a lot when I got to Florida. You know, well, Elvis died, have another drink. I went back to New York because I started getting into some emotional stuff that scared me, and I didn't feel real good, and I had a lot of some physical problems. So I went to a doctor over there in Miami, and he gave me blood work up and stuff, and he said to me, you know something? He said, you have liver problems. You have blood problems. You have so many physical problems that are just getting ready to start with you. He said, I would say that if you don't stop drinking. Now, how did he figure out I was drinking? This guy had to be a wizard. He said, if you don't stop drinking the way you drink, he said, I don't give you much more than 6 months. And I said, well, what's going to be then? He said, you're probably going to die. I said, what does he know? What a quack. I am so sorry I went to him. And I said, well, you know, it's this Florida. They have nothing but quacks here. So I packed my bags and moved up to New York and never went to a doctor again because I didn't trust them either. Kept on partying, kept on drinking. Got back to New York, got one of my old jobs back, really good job. Felt worse and worse, got crazier and crazier inside. The thoughts that were coming to me now, if I didn't have a drink, I started shaking a little bit. I'd get real irritable. I was just, my emotions were going like this, whatever they were. Terrified all the time. Couldn't imagine. I felt that I was losing the grip. I felt that grip was going. And I didn't know what in God's name was wrong with me. I knew I never wanted to be like my dad. But the denial of the disease told me, you're not like your dad. It's something else. But I never would allow myself to think, what is it? Never. I never allowed that. The connection was always there, but I would absolutely refuse to look at it. I talked to some friends that summer, and a lot of my friends from show business were doing Las Vegas. And they said, Sharon, why don't you come to Las Vegas? We're all out there. We're doing this. We're doing that. I said, that's it. I'll go to Las Vegas. I will go to Las Vegas. It's New York and it's Florida and it's boring here and there's nothing happening. That's where I'll go. So, and then my two kids, my daughter had come back when I lived in Florida, and then my son ultimately came back too. They didn't make it with their dad. He still was a heavy drinker, and they were horrified, and they didn't want to be with him either. So they came back, and then my son kept running away to Florida all the time. By now he was into a lot of heavier stuff than just marijuana and Heineken's. He was into some heavy, heavy drugs. And he was also selling as well as doing, and all kinds of crazy people were involved in his life. And I thought, that's what I'll do. I'll take these kids to Las Vegas, and I'll get them out of their environment, and they'll be fine. It's this crummy New York. And mind you, I always loved New York. Crummy New York. So off we went. I made arrangements. I worked for the summer. During that summer, I got so terrified a couple of times in my drinking, and I came home, and I would wake up in my bed, and I didn't know how I got there. I didn't know where I'd been, for sure. I didn't know what happened. And I said, God Almighty, what is going on with me? And then I decided I was losing my mind. So I stopped drinking for a few days, and I started to shake, and I started to fall apart, and I started to cry and be sick. And I said, I'm having a nervous breakdown. That's what's been all along. Look at my life. It's so stressful. So I got admitted to this big hospital in upstate New York called Falkirk, and on one side is a mental institution, and on the other side was a hospital for alcoholism. And so I wanted to go to that nut side. I did not want to be in there with those alcoholics. And I said, that's it. I'm having a nervous breakdown. Well, they got me into the mental side for a while, and they kept me there, 2 hours maybe? And over I went. And I was like, wait a minute, let's talk this over. Boom. I went. They put me in a locked room. They locked the room, and all that was on the floor was a mattress. And I thought, you know, the nerve of them. Do they know who I am? Do you have any idea who I am? Here, you can't put me in this room. And they said, we know who you are. Click. The door got locked. So bad. But then they gave me chloral hydrate. And then for any of you that don't know what chloral hydrate is, you take one drink of it and you pass out. If you're sitting on the side of your bed, you fall in the bed and you're gone. And that was the greatest stuff I ever had because I used to walk around on it. They'd give it to me and I'd walk around on it a while. Just, you know, before I hit the bed, I learned how to play with that. So I did 30 days there and after 30 days of beauty parlor and tennis courts and dining room waiters, you know, and the whole nine yards, God, I felt great. It was like one of these big old English castles up on a hill, you know. My poor second ex-husband, you know, this poor guy, I mean, he went with the money, fix her. And I'm in there getting fixed. Boy, after 30 days, I looked good, I smelled good, I felt good, and I said, look at that. I went to a couple of AA meetings while I was there because it was mandatory, and I sat with these people, and I said, oh, aren't they a pity? God, I wish I could do something for them, you know? I wish I could help these people. But oh well. That was my head. Oh well. I left there, and within a month, I was drunk again. And for some reason, something sneaked in somewhere during that time that I was in that treatment center. Because the drinking was never the same. It never was the same anymore. For some reason, when I drank, I didn't feel right about drinking. And when I didn't feel right about drinking, I got drunk when I didn't want to. And when I didn't want to drink, I drank. And when I wanted to stop, I couldn't. And I would go on these binges where I'd drink for 5 days straight. I must have had 16 broken ankles that year at work. Hello, I broke my ankle. I twisted my ankle. You know, 22 wisdom teeth. I had my wisdom teeth removed, you know. But Sharon, you had them removed last month. Well, it's these other two in front of it, you know. I was dying on my feet. I couldn't believe it. And I kept on going. I don't want to be like those people. I don't want to be like my dad. So off I, then that was when the decision came to go to Las Vegas. I got the kids back. I lured them back from wherever they were. And I said, listen, we're going to move to Las Vegas. How would you like to do that? Oh, Mom, cool. Let's go. All right, come on. Come on home. We're going. So the two older children and I packed up. I sold everything. I had some beautiful antiques, some beautiful things, and wonderful, wonderful things that I'd had for years and years and years. Everything. Sold it off. Boom. Get rid of it. Get rid of it. I want to travel light. The night before I left to travel light, I went out with my friends and partied and drank, and somehow I hit my brakes. It was raining. I don't know how this happened. But I hit my brakes, and the guy in back of me crunched me into a U-Haul truck. And my car was between. So it got mushed in the front and mushed in the back. So the two front end and the back end of the car was crumped. And the next day I left for Vegas. I took it to my garage guy, and he said, Sharon, you need work on this car. I said, don't worry, it's a new car. He said, but your hood keeps flying up. I said, well, get a rope and tie it down. I'm leaving. And that's exactly what I did. I had him tie my hood down, and I left. The day I left, my Tammy, my third child, was 11 years old at that time. And I left her with her dad. And I remember leaving, and I remember seeing that little face. Because my Becky today is 11 years old, and I've thought about it recently. And I saw her little face, and she said, Mommy, I don't want you to go. I wish you wouldn't leave me. And I said, Tammy, you'll be fine. I will get out to Las Vegas, I'll get settled, and I'll send for you. You will be fine. Mommy, please don't leave me. Please take me with you, Mommy. I said, I can't. I have to go get settled. You have to stay with your dad, you'll be fine. And I remember her begging me and crying, and I drove away. I said, you'll be fine. That bothered me a lot. So I had a drink. You know, and when I'd be by myself and I'd see that little face and she had huge blue eyes and the tears were coming down. Mommy, please don't leave me. I had another drink. Got to Vegas, ran into a bunch of people, and I was here and I was there and I was partying. I lasted. I got to Vegas October 16th, 1979. And I was done drinking November 20th, 1979. That's how long I lasted in Vegas. I got in a party that didn't quit. I got so distraught. I got to a place where I was drinking around the clock. I was insane. I wouldn't go out of my house. I became paranoid. My son was in Vegas 1 week, and a guy came to the door, knock, 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 with all the jewelry hanging off him, and he said to me, hey, honey, I fronted your kid a gram of coke. I want my money. I said, how dare you come to my house? Slammed the door. He was into it right there. I didn't realize that we took it with us. We took the entire package with us. And my poor daughter, my son is going this way and I'm going that way. And Lisa's saying, Todd, Mom. Finally one day and I'm drinking and partying and she said to me, you know what, Mom? She said, you are going to die. You are going to drink and you are going to die. And I love you so much. And you are the neatest mom when you don't drink. And she said, you know what? I won't stay here and watch you die. Because you are going to die. And I can't believe you're doing this. And how could you die and leave me? And she said, and my dad drinks too. And I don't want to live with Dad either. But I got to go live with Dad. Because his house, at least in his house, there's Elaine. That was her father's wife. And Elaine doesn't drink. And at least I've got Elaine. And she packed her bags and she left me. And I drank my brains out of that. Drank my brains out. Now it was my son and myself. The devil and the deep blue sea. And here we were, partying, drinking. He went his way, I went mine. We got into fighting and arguing and screaming at each other and carrying on. So finally, he took off, and he took my car. I was passed out someplace, out with my friends or somewhere. He took my car, he took the last of the money, he held a sale in the apartment and sold off my jewelry, my furs, everything that was there. Had a big yard sale. Here, you want this diamond and ruby ring? How about $20? He had to get to Florida. And so when I finally managed to get myself home, the last of what I had was gone. A few clothes hanging in the closet. One silk coat. I was devastated. My stuff. I never even stopped to think my kid. My stuff. I freaked out. I absolutely freaked out, and my son had taken off with the car, with no license, and he was gone. And when I called the police, they said to me, if you report that car stolen, and he's going interstate, and if, in fact, he is carrying drugs, and they stop him and he resists, they will have the right to shoot him. And I said, well, forget I called. So I didn't do anything about it. I sat there and I drank and I felt bad and I felt sorry and look what the world's done to me and poor old pitiful me and oh my God, and I've had all these husbands and all these awful kids and all these troubles. Never stopped to think about anything other than me, 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 and me. Didn't care a fig about anybody else and what maybe they went through. I was down to the bottom of the bottom. And I said to myself, you know, I gotta kill myself. I cannot live like this. I had a prescription of Valium that I'd weaseled out of some doctor in New York before I left for Vegas. And I had about 2 quarts of whiskey in the house and 1 gallon of wine. And I took the full prescription of Valium, and I drank the 2 quarts of whiskey. And I seriously, seriously intended to die. I was out of ideas. I was out of everything. I had no idea what to do. Couldn't get on that bus. I went to my bed and I lay down and I said, you know what? I've had it. But deep inside, I know that even then was a selfish, selfish act. I'll show them. I'll kill myself. They'll all feel bad. And I was absolutely so selfish, so self-centered, and so wrapped up in me that I never stopped to think about anybody else but myself, even in killing myself. Tremendously selfish act. Any fool can kill themselves. As I've learned since I've been here, it's a lot easier to die than to live sometimes. I didn't die, and I don't know why. A day and a half later, I was by myself, I never called anybody. I woke up between my bedroom and my bathroom on the floor. All my bodily functions had stopped. I don't know where I went, but I do know as I started to come to, there was sort of this ringing, like when you hear a waterfall or something, and I kept hearing, you're not done, you're not done, and it was sort of like, get away, like a radio playing somewhere or something. And I woke up, and I crawled out to the kitchen because I couldn't get on my feet, and yanked the phone down off the counter and put my finger in the phone, and I don't know to this day what I dialed. I think I dialed O. I don't know what I said. I do not remember because it blacked out again. Next thing I knew, 2 women were picking me up off the floor. And they were 2 women from AA. And here they are talking like, oh, my God, look how bad she looks. Well, geez, let's get some clothes on. And I remember this, and they're pulling me and yanking me. And they decided, as I'm laying there, she needs a meeting. So they stuffed me into my clothes. They crammed me into my clothes, you know, arms and legs all over the place. And they're dragging me out the door of my apartment. As I'm going, I say, no, I want my silk coat. Okay. Get the silk coat. You know, you had to wear silk. I mean, it's the only way to appear. So here I am. My hair was sticking up straight. And most of my hair was gone because from, you know, no nutrition or anything, my hair fell off and fell out and went everywhere, you know. I was a dream walking. And here I had to have this silk coat. So they took me to, they said, well, what meeting? And I remember saying, and they're talking, and I'm coming and going in and out of consciousness, and I'm saying, help me, you know, there's something really wrong with me. Oh, if you need a meeting, you'll be fine. I'm going, no, I think it's worse than that. No, you're fine. Well, there's 110 meetings a day in Las Vegas and the and that particular time, these 2 women could not find a meeting. They found 1 meeting, and that meeting was in a rehab place called We Care, okay? And that particular day was a gay women's meeting. And all I remember as I started to come to was these stunning looking women, but they were wearing neckties and cufflinks and briefcases and bow ties, and I thought, what am I doing here, you know? And I'm looking around, all these people look the same, and I looked at me and I said, oh my God, you know, maybe I'm gay. I got married all those times, and that's where I went wrong. I'm probably gay. What else would I be doing here? And I was so used to them by blackouts not knowing what I did. I didn't, you know, it was like wherever I wound up, that was what I was doing that day. So there I was. And I was sitting at the chair and I kept stiffening out. I was going through these tremors and stuff, and my body would stiffen out and I'd slide off the chair, or I'd fall up this way, and they'd put me back in. And one of those women at that meeting around that big table looked at these two women that had me there and said, "You know something? You better get her to a hospital. She's in rough shape." And they kept pulling me back in the chair, so we did go to the hospital. After that meeting, they took me to the hospital. And when they tried to get blood out of my veins, it clotted. There was absolutely, my blood was so thick that it wouldn't come out. And the little old doctor, I'll never forget this little man in the intensive care, the emergency area there that they took me into, looked at me and he said to me, and he's poking my stomach and I couldn't stand it. My liver was out to here someplace. And he looked at me and he said, "You know something, young woman?" I was just flattered that he called me young. I mean, I felt like a hag, you know. He said, "I don't know why you're alive. I do not know why you are alive." And they gave me some vitamin K. I wound up in what they call, we don't have them here that I know of, maybe we do, but out there they call them a grab your ass and hurt detox. And those are for the people that really are not teachable and are totally unwilling. Today I call them rarelys. You know, rarely have we seen a person fail. I was a rarely. I was absolutely not cooperative at all to what was going on with me. Well, I shook. I laid there for 5 days. And I shook, and I shook, and I shook. And I was sick like a dog. During that time that I was in that detox, and they had no hot water, by the way, cold water in November. Want a bath? There it is. I remember I was there for Thanksgiving, and a little man was held. I was sitting on the couch, and I kept falling over in the couch, and this little man, and he had a big beard. And he went and got a Thanksgiving dinner and cut it up in little hunks. And he put his arm around my head because I couldn't chew and I couldn't hold a fork or I couldn't do anything. He held me like this. And he was stuffing that food into my mouth. And I remember looking up and I thought to myself, I wonder if he has fleas in that beard. Still didn't recognize the love and the kindness. I was worried about fleas. God love him. And he held me just like a baby and he fed me. It was the first meal I'd had in months. I never ate. Those two same women that took me to that other meeting came, there they were again. "You need a meeting." I was like, "I hope you die." I'm like, "Go away." They took me to a meeting that was the 20th birthday, for 20th AA birthday for a lady in Las Vegas. Her name was Louise R. And it was a huge hall, probably as big as this one. Tremendous amount of people, food, cakes, goodies, cookies, whatever. And people were laughing and they were having a good time, and finally this lady got up and she spoke. And I remember just listening to her and looking at her. Beautiful black woman, her eyes are this big and they're like coals, and when she looks at you across the room, they go right through you. Her eyes just bore a hole right through you. After she spoke, she was mingling around. There was more fellowship and whatever. She came over and she stood right in front of me, and I was way in the corner. I didn't want anybody to see me. I'm wearing my silk coat, you know, but I'm over there. I didn't want to fool with these people. She stood right in front of me and she said, "Honey, do you know what you want?" And I said, "I don't want to be like this anymore." And she said, "Okay." And she walked away. And I thought, the nerve of her. She didn't even stay to chat. Like I was chattable. I mean, my God, my eyes were everywhere, you know. They're probably hanging on my cheeks. But anyhow, next thing I knew, I was in a rehab. A little family-type rehab. Not the kind like we have today, the big hospitals and that. With an office, a living room, a dorm, and a big family-style kitchen and a little, you know, place to do your laundry and stuff. It's like a big home, more or less. And they had 16 people there. No, 18 people. 12 men and 6 women. She had one bed left. And she told those two women, "I have one bed left. I want her in it." And the next day, that's where I wound up. And do you know, I was there 6 weeks before I realized, because I would be asking people, "Why do they call this place Reality House? Why do they call this place Reality House?" I didn't realize. I was there 6 weeks before it made sense what Reality House meant. You're here to find the reality. November 20th, 1979 is my sobriety date. From that day to this, I never had to take another drink. You need to know, probably, that my sobriety has not been fun. It's not been easy. My sobriety for a great amount of those years has been harder and worse 100-fold than the years that I drank, as far as the things that I could not control. except the things I cannot change. I was sober 17 months. Oh, well, I was in detox, by the way. You know, let you know how together I was. While I was in rehab, I met the most stunning guy. Of course! I didn't want to face life. I didn't want to stand on my feet or do anything. I mean, here's this guy. You know, he had a good job at the Hilton. He was cute-looking, big blonde type of person. And he said to me, and he's from Texas, he said, "Damn, honey, you know, when you start to clean up, you don't look too bad." And I thought, well, aren't you cute? That was by far. My sobriety went down, and then when I got sober, it went lower. Because that was, without a doubt, you know, my comeuppance was that move. I married that guy. And I don't know if any of you have ever heard of a sociopath. That's a person that has absolutely no conscience and is basically insane, you know, from drinking, but can put on a good front. Well, I bought it, and it's like biting the bullet. And worse of all, or better of all, however you look at it, I hadn't had a child in 13 years, and I was told after my Tammy was born and then that I would never have another child, and for 13 years I never used birth control, and I never got another child, so I figured, you know, well, that's proof enough. I mean, I slept with these guys, and I knew they had kids, and nothing ever happened to me. Lo and behold, I was working cocktails in the Fremont downtown. Now I'm 2 months sober, and I'm living with this guy, and I got it all made again, and things are looking better. And my sponsor said, "Sharon, Louise, by the way, became my sponsor. You shouldn't be working those cocktails, and you certainly should get rid of him. You know, he's just a bag of nothing, honey." Well, what did she know? She's only my sponsor. She didn't know anything. Now I look good, I smell good, and you know, I was fine. I wasn't drinking, though. Well, I started feeling sick at work, and when you wear cocktails, you have to wear high heels, and you call it that tray way up high, and it's kind of an awkward way, you know, that you walk, but you have to make it look good. And I started getting these pains in my stomach and down my legs and stuff, and I finally went to a doctor, and the doctor said to me, "How many kids do you have?" And I said, "I have three." And he said, "You don't know what's wrong with you?" And I said, "No." And he said, "What's wrong with me?" He said, "You're 12 weeks pregnant, at least." I said, "What? That can't happen to me." So he sent me across the street to the Sunrise Hospital, and they did an ultrasound, and there was this person swimming. And you know, I got the greatest feeling, I don't know why, to this day, I will never know, but I got this feeling of overwhelming joy. I looked at that little thing on that screen, and I saw a little butt and little legs that looked like lollipop sticks. And I said, "That's a girl, and she's going to have the world's most gorgeous legs." And I knew I was having a baby. And I went home to that guy, and he freaked. "I don't want no kid." I said, "Well, you don't have to have one. I'm having one. And you can go where you can stay. I don't care. I'll get by." For the first time in my life, I was willing to care about something other than my selfish self. And I don't know why. Something inside filled me with such a feeling of, like, I want this baby more than I ever wanted anything in my life. And I want the chance once in my life to do it right. My son was still out there missing in Florida, you know, in the land of whatever. My little one was still with her dad in New York because I hadn't been able to get her yet because their dad then sued me for custody and I was fighting that to try to even see her. My oldest daughter was still living with her dad in Tucson. And I didn't care about anything. I was having my baby. I ultimately wound up marrying this guy. But I didn't even care about that. I knew I was having this baby, and I kept saying to my sponsor, "I don't know why I'm having this baby." And she said, "Sharon, for once in your life, try not to figure it all out. Just go ahead. If you want to have that baby, and you don't have to marry that jerk, we'll help you." I still didn't have the program down pat, though. I went to meetings, and I tried, and I listened, but I didn't have it. There's something still missing inside, because I still wanted to do it my way. So I married him. And I had that little girl. And I turned 1 year sober November 13th, 1980, and Becky was born December 2nd, 1980. 6 months later, I got a call. I had talked to my son around Valentine's Day that year in Florida, and, "Oh, Mom, I'm doing great," and of course, you know, "I'm smoking a little weed, but I'm doing fine, and I'm living good," and whatever. I got a call one morning. My daughter was in Tucson, my oldest daughter, my little one was still in New York. I got a call from my sister, who still lived in Florida, and she said to me, lived in Hollywood, Florida, she said, "I got a call from the police. You need to come to Florida right away. They won't give me any information, but Todd's been shot." And I said, what, this, that? And she said, I don't have any information. They got a hold of her through her business. And that my son's girlfriend had known that he had an aunt living there. I got on the next plane out of Las Vegas with my oldest daughter. I called Lisa. Maybe Lisa was with us. I'm not sure. She might have been there. But anyway, I know Lisa and I and the baby wound up in the plane. Becky was 6 months old. We flew to Florida. I called his father, and his father said, what'd you do, shoot him in the self in the toe? I said, I don't know, but I got to go. He said, well, you call me when you get there and let me know. I walked into Jackson Memorial Hospital with the baby in my arms when we got here after flying all night. Walked in, they escorted me to the intensive care, and there was my son. And he had been involved with Argentinian drug dealers, I found out later, dealing and buying and living that life. And he wanted out because he had been telling me that February, I want to come to Vegas, Mommy. I want to leave Florida and I want to come to you. And I said, Todd, you're welcome, but we won't have... If you come, you're either going to get off your drugs or you're going to go to treatment because we don't live like that anymore. But I dearly love you and I dearly want a chance. And if you want to come, come on. That was the last conversation I ever had with my son. My son had a bullet in his head that went in the back base of his skull and came out the top. I walked into that room and I took my son's arm and I held onto his arm and I said, Todd, it's Mommy and I'm here. And for some reason, as I held his arm, I saw a scar on his left forefinger that when he was 7 years old, he had a planter's wart on his finger. And I took him to have it removed. And I remember he screamed and cried when they gave him that needle and they took that thing out of his finger. And I held him so tight and I said, I'm here. Mommy's here. You're going to be okay. I love you. And I remember feeling that. And I took my son's arm again. And for some reason, there was that same wart, that same mark. And I said, Todd, I'm here. Mommy's here. It's okay. I love you. I love you. And two tears came out of his eyes. And he never moved. Nothing moved. And after a few minutes, I just kept holding his hand in his arm, and I kept talking to him and saying, I love you. I love you. And I talked to him, and I did my ninth step and my 10th step and my 11th step and my 12th step with that boy right there, and I just couldn't stop. I just said, my God in heaven, I love you so much. Please, please stay with me. Please give me a chance. Please give me a chance. And he went like this. When he was little, the style was little short pants with the turtlenecks and little sport jackets for a little boy. He hated turtlenecks. And he used to walk around saying, get it off, get it off. And he would haunt everybody to the point that somebody would take his shirt off. And I know that was the message he was giving me. Get it off. Get this body off of me. My son went brain dead. I never got a chance to talk to him again. They did give me the chance to keep him on life supports or let him go. And I knew... I had an out-of-body experience. I went up in the corner of the room, and I looked down. I saw the back of my hair, my blouse, my skirt, my shoes, all rumpled and wrinkled. And I saw my son lying in the bed. And when I came back, I knew that he needed to go. And that's what we did, and he lived 4 hours. Took the life supports off him. I went to the phone, and I got on my knees in the phone booth. I had the baby in my arms, and I said to my... I called my sponsor in Vegas, and I said, my God, Louise, my God, help me, help me, help me. I can't do this. I can't live through this. The guilt, the feeling, my son. I was never there for him, and now I'd never have the chance. And now I wasn't drinking anymore, and there was nowhere to go and nowhere to run and nowhere to hide. I could do nothing. And my sponsor said, oh, yes, you can. You can get on your knees. God could and would if sought. That's what you need to do, Sharon. Get on your knees. Get on your knees. And she said, and now if you take a drink, what's going to happen to that baby in your arms? What's going to happen to that little girl? Who's going to take care of Becky? She said, you don't have a choice, baby. You don't have a choice. And I didn't. I did not have a choice. For the first time in my life, something meant more to me than myself. My son went... And we barely picked ourselves up. In 4 years, we started to live again a little bit. I kept going to meetings. I didn't drink. I walked around like a mummy for about a year or two, in and out, you know. But in 1984, my marriage in Vegas was over, and I was going to move to Florida. Again, I needed a geographical. But this time, it wasn't a run. This time, it was a planned thing. So the girls and I, Lisa and Tammy, my third child, and Becky, all moved to Florida. And we had a young man with us that I met in Vegas, a young Mexican man who was left in the streets for dead. And he became my honorary son. And and we became so close, and he got sober. He'll have 10 years in June. And we all came to Florida. Here we were. We took a house down by Venice Beach, and we had a good time, and everybody got jobs, and the girls were good. My oldest daughter and I got jobs, and Gus got a job, and we were all working. We had a good time. We had AA people coming and going in and out the coffee pot. That's when I met Matt and all this whole neat crowd, and started cooking and jiving in Venice and making a life for ourselves. And for the first time in a long, long time, I was happy, joyous, and free. I had my program. I had my life. I had my girls. I thought maybe I'll make it. In October of 1985, we moved here in June of 84. Tammy was going to the airport. That was my third child that I left behind in New York originally. She ultimately came to live with me, by the way, in Vegas. And we had many good years together, even in Vegas. And I got the chance to be mom. I got the chance to be what I wanted to be that I never got the chance to do for my son. I was mom. I was there for her. She was going to Sarasota Bradenton Airport to pick up a little friend coming in from New York. And she was going through a flashing yellow light. And a man that had been drinking was going through a flashing red at about 55 miles an hour. He hit her little Mustang, and he was driving a Bronco, and he flew up in the air, and he came down on top of her car. And it was an hour and a half before they could get Tammy and her friend out of her car. Her friend survived. Tammy went brain dead. And I was given the choice again. Your daughter is brain dead. The best she'll be is a vegetable. You have to make the decision. And I couldn't stand it. It was like, why? Why? And why not? Why not? Again, it was deja vu. I was on my knees again. I was screaming at my sponsor on the phone, Louise, help me, help me. This time she got on a plane. And this time she came to me. That woman's always been there for me, no matter what. This time she got on a plane. I was like a maniac. I could not believe it. And then I went numb. And somewhere I went someplace. And I know today that the higher power put something around me. Because I just went numb. And I just didn't drink. And I stayed on my knees. And I went down the beach and I screamed and I cried. And I couldn't believe it. My God, how can I do this? How can anybody do this? You know what she told me? God could and would have thought. Sharon, you can do it. You can do it. You don't have to take a drink. This is life. Life does happen. The only thing I didn't do was I didn't take a drink. I died. A piece of me died inside. Twice. You know, but life is life. I went on. Stayed numb as long as I needed to stay numb. I still went back to work. I lived my life. Got involved with the people in the program. They held me when I couldn't stand it. They were with me. They loved me when I couldn't love myself. They helped me emotionally. They supported me. And you know, one of the miracles of this program is that if we try hard enough, and when we can't handle anymore, when we flat can't handle anymore, God does take over. My daughter Tammy had a vision. And it happened twice. And the second time that she had that vision. And what 18-year-old has a vision? They're into rock and roll. They don't want to know from visions. She had a vision. She saw a bright light, and in front of that light, she saw two people. Twice she passed out and came to and had a vision the year before she died. And you know what she said? Mommy, I think it was me and Todd. And after she was gone, I knew. I said, thank you, God. You didn't come and put a letter in my mailbox. You didn't knock on my door and say, good morning, this is God. I gotta tell you what I got to do here. But he did give me a message. Because for an 18-year-old to have an experience like that, to pass out, go into a cold sweat, and come through again and say, I saw my brother and I in a bright light, and this is before she died. And when she was gone, I didn't know why. I don't know why today. I'll never know why. But I do know it's okay. I do know everything's where it's supposed to be. I've learned everything about life that I know today in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea how to live when I got here. I had a glitzy life. I've had it all. I've been a very blessed woman in a lot of ways. And I've had one of the most tragic lives that I know. Because when I got ready enough to do the right thing, I never got the chance with my son. Never. And what I learned from that, though, in working with others, is that if they've got somebody in your life that you love, take a good look at them and hug them and kiss them and tell them you love them. Because are you so sure they're going to be there tomorrow? And if you got somebody that you got a gripe with, and you got somebody that you need to straighten something out with, for heaven's sakes. Next week might not get there. And in my particular case, for what I've learned and what I felt, it would have been a lot easier to be the one checking out than the one to have to stay here and work through that stuff and feel those feelings and walk the floor at night and look up in the stars and wonder, where are they? Where are my babies today? And I know that God gave me another gift, because when I had that little baby and didn't know where I was getting her from some lunatic, beautiful, healthy, wonderful little child, I know that God at that point in time, I truly believe he was lessening the blow beforehand. I'll give you something to make your life worthwhile. Something has to go, but you're going to get something back. I never thought like that. These rooms have given it all to me. The people in these rooms, the love in these rooms, my God, my higher power, whom I choose to call God, my sponsor, the people that loved me when I couldn't love myself. And today that's what I do. I'm going to school till my brains are falling out, because I believe not only in carrying the message in these rooms, I believe in carrying the message individually to people that maybe can't get to that door and open it. I was thrown through. I had no choice. A lot of people, the choice is too strong. I was thrown. It was grow or go. When I walked into that funeral parlor and I saw my 18-year-old son in a box and smelled that formaldehyde and held his hand and it was cold, and I knew that I would never again on the face of this earth ever be able to make up to that boy what I didn't give him, that's when I went through the door. And I know today, I thank God that he kicked me through that door. I know today, my sponsor told me, Sharon, wisdom will come to you if you hang in and you stay with us beyond your wildest dreams, because God doesn't take away unless he replaces. I know that today. I know that I was given the gift of alcoholism. My dad died in November. I went up to see him like this. He was in the hospital, no danger of anything. I said, I got to go see my dad. I went up and I held his hand. And he said to me, Sharon, I haven't been a good father to you. I said, Daddy, it's okay. I love you. And he said, you know, I'm so old. I don't want to be here anymore. I said, you can go. I said, you've had a good life and you can go and I love you. And he died the next morning at 7:00 in the morning. So it came full circle. And they know what I got to do today. And you know, the basis of my program is laughter and joy. 2 weeks ago, guess what I went and did? Got married again. Most wonderful guy. This time, you know, I spent 4 years on my own, alone and celibate, and worked on me and my insanity. I was recommended to me. Let me tell you something. Some of those nights get pretty long. But I came to a conclusion that I would rather be alone than mess up another life or put myself or my family through any more of that junk. And one day, this person was dropped into my lap, literally. Wonderful man. And we're both of the program. You know, we're both curly around the edges, and we got some kinks to straighten out. But the main thing is we both know where we're going. We want to be well, and we want to be sober. It's a gift. It's a blessing. Thank you very much for having me tonight.